Save big money on protecting your garden now at Menards. Messina's Animal Stopper is a liquid repellent that prevents animals from damaging your garden. Available in a convenient, ready-to-use bottle. It lasts for up to 30 days, regardless of weather and watering. Save big money on Messina's Animal Stopper at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Someone delivered the sheriff's cell phone to the police station in an unmarked cardboard box. I'm the only one who made it out of town alive. So, Levi, let me get this straight. Noah just so happened to be recording a voice memo exactly when the home invasion started? That's one hell of a coincidence, given that my brother barely used his cell phone to text, let alone record himself. Sergeant Landry barked from my office doorway, face flushed bright red. To be clear, this wasn't at all what I was trying to say, but the maniac had interrupted me before I got to the punchline. He moved closer, slamming a meaty paw on my desk to support his bulky frame as he positioned himself to tower directly over me. Although it had been over a decade since I'd last seen him, Landry hadn't changed one bit. Same old power-drunk Neanderthal who communicated better via displays of wrath and intimidation than he did the English language. I leaned back in my chair in an effort to create some distance. Then I froze, stayed completely still as if the man was an agitated Rottweiler that had somehow stumbled into my office, scared that any sudden movements could provoke an attack. As much as I hated the man, as much as I wanted to meet his gaze with courage, I couldn't do it. Pains me to admit it, but I don't have the bravery. Not at first. Instead, my eyes settled lower, and I watched his thick, white jowls vibrate in the wake of his impromptu tantrum as I stammered out a response. "Like I said, Sergeant, we found the sheriff's phone in the mail today. Hand-delivered in a soggy cardboard box with no return address. Message scribbled on the inside of the box read, 'Voice memo,' and nothing else. So believe me when I say that I'm just telling you what I know. Not claiming to understand why, nor am I saying the sheriff's disappearance and the recording are an unrelated coincidence. It's only been 10 or so hours. Everything's a touch preliminary, and I'm starting to think the recording will speak for itself better than I can explain it," I mumbled. I waited for a response. Without my feeble attempt at confidence filling the space, an unease quietly settled over the room. The silence was heavy like smoke, felt liable to choke on. Finally, I mustered some nerve and looked Landry in the eye. The asshole hadn't moved an inch. He was still towering over me, blocking the ceiling lamp in such a way that the light faintly outlined his silhouette, creating an angry, flesh-bound eclipse. The sweltering Louisiana morning, coupled with the building's broken AC, routinely turned my office into an oven. That day was no exception. As a result, sweat had begun to accumulate over Landry, splotches in his armpits, beads on his forehead, and a tiny pocket of moisture at the tip of his monstrous beer gut, where gravity was dragging an avalanche of fat against the cotton of his overstuffed white button-down. The bastard was becoming downright tropical as he leaned over me, still as a statue. Despite his glowering, I kept my cool, gestured towards my computer monitor without breaking eye contact. "I get it. You come home all the way from New Orleans because Noah's your brother, even if you two never quite got along. Believe it or not, I want to find him too. So you could either continue to jump down my throat about every little thing, or I could show you what we have in terms of evidence." Landry stood up, his expression relaxed, from an active snarl to his more baseline smoldering indignation. He pulled a weathered handkerchief from his breast pocket, which may have been the same white as his button down at some point, but had since turned a sickly, jaundiced yellow after years of wear and tear. The sergeant dabbed the poor scrap of cloth against his forehead a few times, as if that was gonna do fuck all to remedy the fact that the man was practically melting in front of me.
"All right, son, show me," he grumbled, trudging over to a chair against the wall opposite my desk.
I breathed a sigh of relief and turned my attention to the computer, shaking the mouse to wake the monitor. I was about to click the audio file, but I became distracted by the flickering movement of wings from outside a window Landry had previously been blocking. Judging by the gray-white markings, it looked to be a mockingbird. There was something desperately wrong with the creature, though. First off, it hadn't just flown by the window in passing. It was hovering with beak pressed into the glass, an abnormally inert behavior for its species. Not only that, but it appeared to be observing Landry closely as he crossed the room and sat down. Slowly, the animal twisted its head to follow the sergeant, and that's when I better appreciated the thing jutting out of its right eye. A single light pink flower, with a round of petals about the size of a bottle cap, and an inch of thin green stalk separating the bloom from where it had erupted out of the soft meat of the bird's eye. The sharp click of snapping fingers drew my attention back to Landry.
"Hello, deputy. Quit daydreaming about the curve of your boyfriend's cock and play the goddamn recording. Noah ain't got time for this."
Like I said, Landry was the same old, hate-filled, foul-mouthed waste of skin, the used-to-be barbarian king of our small town, nestled in the heart of the remote southern wetlands, had finally come home. The only difference now was that he had exponentially more power than he did when he was the sheriff here instead of his younger brother. Sergeant Landry of the New Orleans Police Department. What a nauseating thought. I swallowed my disgust, nodded, and tapped the play button on the screen. Before the audio officially started, my eyes darted back to the window. No disfigured mockingbird. Just a light dusting of pollen that I couldn't recall having been there just before Landry stormed in. Voice memo recorded on the sheriff's phone. 0 through 8 seconds. Thumbs of feet against wood. 9 through 21 seconds. No further movement. Unintelligible language in the background. By the pitch, sounds male.
Sorry.
22 through 35 seconds. Shuffling of paper. Weight shifting against creaky floorboards. Noah's voice can finally be heard.
"What? What the hell is all this?"
36 through 52 seconds. More unintelligible language.
Sorry.
53 through 1 minute 12 seconds. Noah speaks again, reacting to whoever else is speaking.
No, no, I don't believe you, and I won't do it.
1 minute 13 seconds through 1 minute 45 seconds. One of the home invaders interrupts Noah and bellows loud enough for his words to be picked up on the recording. Their voice is deep and guttural, but also wet sounding. Each syllable gurgles over their vocal cords like they are being waterboarded, speech soaked in some vicious fluid. They can't seem to croak more than two words at a time without needing to pause.
Read now. You read. We spare children. Otherwise, they watch. Not much time, Noah.
1 minute 46 seconds through 2 minutes and 1 second. Silence. 2 minutes and 2 seconds through 2 minutes and 45 seconds. Shuffling of paper. Can't be sure, but it seems like the sheriff was reading a prepared statement provided by the intruders. Noah adopts a tone of voice that was unmistakably oratory, spoken with a flat effect, stumbled over a few words, repeated a handful of others, etc.
Hello.
Town name redacted for reasons that will become clear later.
We are your discarded past. The devil's in your details. Your cruel antebellum. We may have been sunken deep. You may have thought us gone forever. But we are the lotus of the mire. We have risen from the mud, from the depths of the trench of rectify our history. You may have denied our faces, but you will no longer deny our deaths. We will lay the facts bare. We will recreate your greatest deviance, the emblem of your hideous nature, and you will watch us do it. You will watch over and over again until your eyes become dust in your skulls, and only then will we return you to the earth.
2 minutes 46 seconds through 4 minutes and 40 seconds. Noah recites one more sentence. His voice begins to change. It's like his speech had become pre-recorded and artificially slowed down after the fact. His tone shifts multiple octaves lower. Every word becomes stretched, unnaturally elongated. Certain syllables drone on for so long that they lose meaning. They become this slow, churning hum, like a war horn or an old HVAC system turning on. I believe the sentence Noah said was, "We have hung, you will rot." But it sounded like this.
We have hung. Will rot.
About a minute into the humming, Landry sprung to his feet, eyes wide, and gripping the side of his head like he was in the throes of a migraine.
What the hell is wrong with your computer? Turn that contemptible thing off, he screamed.
I scrambled to pause the recording, startled by the outburst. Took me longer than it should have to land the cursor on the pause button. All the while, the hum of Noah saying the word rot buzzed through the speakers. Finally, I clicked, and the hum stopped. I tilted my body and peered over the monitor. Landry was bent over in the center of my cramped office, face drained of color and panting like a dog, hand still on his temple. Truthfully, I wouldn't have minded him keeling over. I liked picturing his chest filled with clotted blood from some overdue heart attack. Wasn't crazy about him expiring in my office, though. The stench would have been unbearable.
You need me to call an ambulance or... Landry reached out an arm, palm facing me. I'm fine.
He retrieved the handkerchief again, wiping it more generously against his face the second time around, up and down both cheeks and under his chin. Once he was breathing close to normal, Landry straightened his spine, ran a few fingers through his soggy, grain-combed hair, and threw a pair of his beady eyes in my direction.
What happened to the end of the recording? Did the file, you know, get corrupted or...
He trailed off. I'm not confident Landry even understood the question he was asking. The man was far from a technological genius. I think he wanted me to tell him I had an explanation for what happened to Noah's voice at the end. I did not. No, the file is fine. The whole phone is fine, I said, mentally bracing for the onslaught of another tantrum. No anger came, though. Landry was reserved, introspect. He looked away, his eyes darting about the room and his brow furrowed, seemingly working through some internal calculations.
And you're sure they didn't find his body? I've seen house fires burn hot enough to turn a man's bones to ash,
he suggests. Nothing yet. At the very end of the recording, after Noah stopped speaking, you could hear what sounds like a body being dragged against the floor, too. I think they took him. We have our people over there right now sifting through the ruins, you know, just in case.
All right, well, keep me posted. I'll be out of town for the next few hours.
I tilted my head, puzzled.
Business back in New Orleans, Sergeant?
He lumbered over to the door and twisted to the knob.
No. I'm gonna look around the old Bordeaux place. Call it a hunch.
I'm glad he didn't turn around as he left. I wouldn't have been able to mask my revulsion. How dare he, of all people, speak that name? An hour later, I was stepping out of the front door of the police station and into the humid, mosquito-filled air. There was an odd smell lingering on the breeze that I had trouble identifying. The scent was floral, but with a ting of chemical sharpness, like a rose dipped in bleach. Whatever it was, it made my eyes water and my sinuses feel heavy. Brown bag in hand, I took a right once I reached the sidewalk and began making my way towards the community garden. My go-to lunch spot was a bench next to a massive red oak tree only 2 blocks away. Shouldn't have taken more than 10 minutes to walk there. That day, it took almost a half an hour. At the time, I wasn't worried. I didn't sense the danger, and I had a reason to be moving slowly, my thoughts preoccupied by what Landry had said as he left my office, so the peculiarity of the delay didn't raise any alarm bells.
I'm gonna look around the old Bordeaux place, call it a hunch.
What a fucking lunatic, I whispered as I lowered myself onto the bench. In retrospect, my voice was slightly off. I hadn't even begun to peel open the brown bag when a wispy scrape of folded paper drifted in the view, landing gently on the grass like the seed heads of a dandelion, dispersing over the land after being blown from their stem by a child with a wish. Then another. The second scrap fell closer, wedging itself into the back collar of my shirt, tapping against my neck in rhythm with the breeze sweeping through the atmosphere. The scraps of paper continued raining down. A few seconds passed, and another half dozen had settled around me. I tilted my head to the sky and used my hand to shield the rays of harsh light projected by the midday sun, attempting to discern the origin of the bombardment. There wasn't much to see, other than a flock of birds flying east. No one else around either. The community garden was usually bustling with some amount of foot traffic, but not that day. I reached my hand around and grabbed the slip still flapping against my neck and unfolded it. The handwriting in the blue ink appeared identical to the message scribbled on the box that Sheriff's phone arrived in earlier that morning. Meet me in the security booth. Come now. Only needed to read two more to realize they all said the same thing. My run from the bench to the security booth is when I first noticed something was off. The security booth was a windowless steel box at the outer edge of town, no more than 300 square feet, crowded by monitors that played grainy live feeds of the six video cameras that kept a watchful eye on the comings and goings of our humble citizens. Four of those cameras were concentrated on what we considered Town Square. From the tops of telephone poles, they maintained their endless vigil, looking after the giant rectangular sign that listed the town's name and population, greeting travelers as they drove into our little island of civilized society amongst a sea of barren, untamed swampland. When I was a teen, the town invested in those extra cameras because the sign was a magnet for graffiti that decried police brutality. I would know. I was one of the ringleaders of said civil activism. Never got caught, thankfully. An arrest would have likely prevented me from joining our town's meager police force down the road. It was all so bizarre. It felt like I was running. Felt like I was sprinting at full force, matter of fact. Lactic acid burned in my calves. My lungs took in large gulps of air, and I felt my chest expand in response. And yet, it took me an hour to arrive at the security booth. Now, I'm no long-distance runner. I don't have a lot of endurance to hang my hat on. That said, I'm perfectly capable of short bursts of speed. Those 500 yards should have taken me 60 seconds, not a whole goddamn hour. Every movement was agonizingly slow, absolutely grueling. It only gets worse once I neared that steel box, too. My muscle fibers screamed from the strain of constant contraction. My legs seethed from the metabolic inferno. But no matter how much my mind willed it, I couldn't force myself to move any faster. The door to the booth was already open as I approached, inch by tortuous inch. I cried out from the hurt. Under normal circumstances, the noise I released should have sounded like, "Ugh!" a grunt of pain. But what actually came out was a deep, odious hum. Before I could become completely paralyzed, my sneakers crawled over the threshold, and I entered the security booth. I commanded my body towards a wheelie chair in front of the wall of monitors, which was conspicuously empty. I ached for the relief of sitting down. As I creeped into the direction of that respite, I heard the door slam behind me at a speed appropriate for reality. I barely registered it. I was much too focused on getting to the chair. Took me about 5 minutes to traverse 3 feet. Thankfully, once I got to aiming my backside at the seat, gravity mercifully assisted with the maneuver. On my toes and off balance, my body tipped over and I collapsed into the chair, sliding backwards and hitting the wall with a low thump. With the door closed, I seemed to recover quickly from the cryptic stasis. My movements become smoother, faster, more aligned with my understanding of reality within a matter of minutes. Eventually, I noticed the object lying on the keyboard. A black helmet with a clear visor and an air filter at the bottom. It was an APR, air purifying respirator, from the fire station. Instinctively, I slipped it on, which only took double the expected time. There was an envelope under it, and it was addressed to me. I opened the fold, pulling out the letter, and scanned the message. Then, I put my eyes on the four monitors that were covering the town's welcome sign. Looked up at the perfect moment. Everyone was there, and the show was about to begin. The Bordeaux family was different. They were French Creole, and their ancestors inhabited the wetlands that surrounded our town long before it was even a thought in someone's head, arrived a half century or so before us, give or take. Originally, their community was fairly large, 200 or so farmers and laborers who had traveled from Nova Scotia and eastern Quebec after being exiled as part of the French and Indian War, looking to dig their roots in somewhere else. Over time, though, their numbers dwindled from a combination of death and further immigration across the U.S. And yet, despite immense hardship, the Bordeaux family remained. They refused to be exiled once again. For reasons I'll never completely understand, our town feared the Bordeaux family. I think they represented the wildness of nature to most of the townsfolk. Some even claimed they practiced black magic, putting their noses up to God as they delved into the forbidden secrets of the land. Goat sacrificing, Satan-worshipping heathens. Of course, that was all bullshit. I knew the Bordeaux family intimately. I was close friends with their kids growing up. They were Catholic, for Christ's sake. They did it a little differently and sounded a little differently when they worshipped, but they were Christian at the same time. But when push came to shove, the truth of their beliefs was irrelevant. Because what is a zealot without a heathen? How could you define light without its contrasting dark? There was a role to be filled in a play that's been going on since the beginning of time, and they became the unlucky volunteers. People like Sergeant Landry needed a heathen. He required someone to blame when things went wrong. Because a God-fearing man should only receive the blessings of this world. And if they didn't, well, there's only one feasible explanation. Interference by the devil and his disciples. So when Landry's firstborn died of a brain tumor, back when he was just Sheriff Landry, he lost his goddamn mind. Within 24 hours, the last five members of the Bordeaux family, three of which were children, were pulled off their secluded home in broad daylight and dragged into the center of town. Despite my tears and pleas, they received their so-called divine punishment, having clearly cursed Landry's child with the tumor out of jealousy or spite. I was only 10. I couldn't stop anyone. The rest of my neighbors just silently watched the Bordeaux family rise into the air. None of them were smiling, but they all watched Landry, Noah, and three more other men pull on those ropes. And when I was old enough, I applied to work at the station. Since I couldn't stop them back then, I planned on rooting out the cancer from the inside. What I saw on those monitors was the exact same event in a sort of reverse. There was a crowd of people gathered in the town square. Most of them weren't moving, stuck in various poses, some crouching, some walking. Many of them looked to be running when they became paralyzed. A gathering of human-sized chest pieces, so still that the birds had begun to perch on top of their heads and their outstretched arms. But no matter their pose, they were all facing the back of the town's welcome sign. As I inspected each of the pseudo-mannequins in disbelief, I noticed the first of five people that were moving. It was a child, weaving through the packed crowd like it was an obstacle course. They were wearing a tattered dress with a few circular holes cut out of it, big enough to allow pink flowers the size of frisbees passing through the fabric from where they grew onto the child's skin to the outside world. The same type of flower I saw growing out of the mockingbird's eye earlier that morning. One over her sternum, one on her right leg, and two on her left arm, all bouncing along with the child as she danced and played. I couldn't see the child's face. They were wearing a mask that seemed to be made out of a deer skull. A tall, muscular man entered the frame, walking through the crowd without urgency. Multiple gigantic flowers littered his chest, so he hadn't bothered with modifying a shirt to allow for their unfettered bloom. His bone mask was large, imposing antlers jutting out from its temples. There was an older man slung over his shoulder, motionless. Even though the monitors lacked definition, I could immediately tell who it was. Landry. Five slack nooses were slung over our town's large rectangular sign. Four of them already had people in them. The rightmost person was Noah. The muscular man slid Landry into the last empty noose like a key into a lock. He backpedaled from the makeshift gallows to appreciate his work. After staring at it for a few minutes, he turned and beckoned to the rambunctious children and the three others I couldn't initially see on the screen. A pair of older twins and a mother figure walking into the frame from the same direction the man had arrived. They gathered together in front of the soon-to-be-hanged. The man wrapped two long arms around his family, the twins on one side and mother and the small child on the other. They marveled at their revenge with reverence, drinking in the spectacle like it was a beautiful sunset or fireworks on New Year's Eve. Finally, the man whistled. I couldn't tell yet what. Maybe he whistled at a larger animal infected with their flowers, like a black bear or a bobcat. Maybe he whistled at a flock of birds, coordinated under his control. Maybe he whistled at some third option that my mind can't even begin to conjure. I didn't watch for much longer, and I didn't drive through the town square on my way out to see for myself. I took the back roads. Whatever was beyond the camera's view on the other side of the town sign, it was strong enough to hang all five of them. Landry, Noah, and three others lifted into the air. The rambunctious child clapped and cheered. The mother figure kissed the man on the cheek. The rest of the town just watched, paralyzed but cautious, which, the more I think about it, wasn't much different from the first time around. But the muscular man wasn't sated. He refused to give Landry and his compatriots a quick death. No. Instead, he signaled to whatever was pulling the nooses by whistling again, and the five of them were lowered back to the ground. A minute later, he whistled, and they were hanging once more. Another recreation of the past that would have never truly been enough to fix anything, but the patriarch of the Bordeaux family would not be deterred. He was dead set on finding that mythical threshold, the point at which vengeance was so pure and concentrated that it could actually rehabilitate history. After watching the fourth hanging, I made sure my gas mask was on tight, and I ran out of the security booth. It was late evening when I opened up the metal door, and I could no longer smell the air. No scent of a rose dipped in bleach crawling up my nostrils. I assumed that meant I was safe. Still, I did not remove the mask until I had reached New Orleans. I slept in a motel, woke up a few hours later in a cold sweat, and started driving north before the sun had risen. The letter. Hello, Levi. I'm not sure what we are anymore. Dad was the first to wake up, too angry to die. Not completely, at least. He woke up and swam to the surface, learned of his cultivation. Soon after, he cultivated Mom, the twins, and then me. After that, we all cultivated the land together. Consider this mercy our thank you for trying that day all those years ago. Dad was against it at first, but I convinced him. Wear the mask to protect yourself, then get out of town. Drive far away. Go north. I don't think we could survive up north. Dad is still angry. I'm not sure what he's gonna do once he's done with those men. But I doubt it all stops here. P.S. If you have the stomach for it, we're about to put on a show for everyone who hurt us. Here's the synopsis. Those who don't learn from the past are doomed to repeat it. Over and over and over and over and over and over again. Until their eyes become dust in their skulls. And only then will we return them to the earth. We have hung. They will rot.